It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. They say opposites attract, but does that mean that they actually belong together?
From Cinderella to the movie Pretty Woman, relationships across social boundaries have been an inspiration for fairy tales and feature films. But here in the United States, with growing attention to the economic divide between rich and poor, how do those relationships play out in reality?
Our next guest went straight to the source and interviewed people who had married someone richer or poorer. She learned about some of the unique challenges facing these relationships.
Jessie Stribe is an assistant professor of sociology at Duke University. She's the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages.
When you talk to couples about their class background, it seems like some of the initial reaction was they didn't want to talk about it in some ways. What kind of reactions did you get when you introduced the idea of talking about cross-class marriages to people who are actually in them?
That's exactly right. So some of the people I talked to didn't think about themselves in a cross-class marriage. I would ask them when the first time they thought of themselves as being in a cross-class marriage was, and they would say something like, when I saw your email, or just now when I'm talking to you. Other people actively denied it. They said, no, we're not in a cross-class marriage because we're both moral people, or we both grew up with hardworking parents. So they found ways to kind of get around thinking about their class differences fairly often.
Why do you think they had the motivation to do that, to not describe themselves as being in a cross-class marriage so much as that they created workarounds?
I think part of the reason is class is so moralized in our country. And so they didn't want to see their partner as somebody who had different morals than them, who was maybe less moral than they were. And so they kind of said, oh, we're all the same. I think another reason is it's really hard to define class and to think about class. And so it's really easy to say, oh, we're middle class. Everybody's middle class. So my partner and I are too. Another reason is that when they met, they were often in the same class. So while they grew up in different classes, by the time they were adults, they were both college educated and often worked in professional jobs. And so they didn't really have to think about their class differences that were in the past anymore. They could focus on the future.
Well, let's look into the differences amidst the couples that you looked at. How roughly did you define class for the purposes of this research? And what were the backgrounds of the people in the marriages that you interviewed?
So I looked at people who grew up in different classes, but who are in the same class as adults. So as adults, they were college educated and they worked in professional white collar jobs, but their backgrounds were different. So in the couples I interviewed, one partner grew up with a father who worked in a blue collar job and who was high school educated, while the other partner grew up with a father who was college educated and worked in a professional white collar job. And often their mothers kind of had similar levels of education as their fathers. So one was a blue-collar background and one was a professional white-collar background.
We're talking about cross-class marriages right now with Jessie Stribe, assistant professor of sociology at Duke and the author of The Power of the Past. And Jessie, when you dug into this, to these cross-class marriages, what did you find stuck out to you first as far as the way people had differences that had to do with their upbringing?
Yeah, so one of the biggest differences I found was how they wanted to live their lives. And so generally, the person from the poorer background, the blue-collar background, tended to want to go with the flow. And their partners who came from more privileged class backgrounds instead wanted to manage everything around them. So they wanted to organize and they wanted to oversee and they wanted to plan, while their partners kind of wanted to take a more hands-off approach and say, we'll figure it out when we get there and it's going to be okay. They worried a lot less. And so managing or taking a more hands-off approach were the biggest differences that I saw with cross-class couples.
And that seems like the sort of thing that might lead toward friction in a couple, having this fundamentally different way of approaching planning a life together.
It definitely could lead to a lot of friction, but it really didn't have to. And so a lot of the couples who were the happiest ones who I talked to found ways to make use of each partner's strengths. So the person who wanted to plan a lot would sometimes say, hey, I need to be more spontaneous sometimes. And my partner's really great at telling me to stop and smell the roses. Or I need to be as spontaneous in this situation. And so I go to her and I ask her how to do it. Whereas the partner from the blue-collar background would say, you know, sometimes I really need to plan more, but I don't know how to do it. And so I'm going to go ask my partner how to do it. And so they could see each other's differences as strengths at times, as well as just differences.
And was that the difference in quality that you talked about, the planning versus people who are more spontaneous, was that something that attracted these people to each other? Was it a case of opposites attract?
There definitely were several cases of opposites attracting. It wasn't always about planning. Often for the person who grew up in a blue-collar community, it was about seeing the other person as very stable. So their partners who grew up with more privilege, often they thought the future was predictable because in their lives it was. And for people who grew up in blue-collar backgrounds, often predictability is a luxury. And so they felt really drawn to these people who just felt like, life is predictable. I know I'm going to go to college and then I'm going to go to grad school and then I'm going to have a good job. And that was a nice sense of security. For their partners who grew up from more privileged class backgrounds, they often felt that their families were less emotionally expressive as they wished. And their partners who grew up in blue-collar families often had really intimate families. And so the partner from more privilege wanted that and liked being around their partner and their family and felt like maybe they could teach them how to be more intimate too.
You mentioned at the outset that there can be moral baggage associated by people, fairly or not, with being from different class backgrounds. Within relationships, did you encounter ever a sense of either inferiority or superiority between the couples, or a sense that they're trying hard not to think of things in that exact way?
I think they tried hard not to think about it that way. Because they denied class, they didn't have to think about one person being better or worse than the other. Where it came up more often was when the in-laws met each other. A lot of times then the partner who came from the blue-collar family, their parents would feel inferior to their son or daughter's new in-laws.
Did you get the sense that these differences you're describing are things that lingered, or are they things that the couples worked on over time and sort of grew to a consensus over?
They definitely lingered. And so the couples stayed pretty different. So the blue-collar partner generally wanted to do less planning, and the more privileged partner generally wanted to do more planning. And that stayed constant throughout their marriages. But I think they got better at figuring out how to deal with those differences over time.
Well, can you bring this to life and maybe share a story or two of the couples, ones that you think really painted a picture of how these challenges work themselves out or not?
Sure. So one couple that I talked to, I call them Christy and Mike. These aren't their real names, mm-hmm. but names I gave them to protect their identities. And Christy and Mike met in seventh grade in the cafeteria, and they had pretty much been dating ever since then. When I met them, they were in their early 40s. They had three children together, and they were, at this time, both college educated. Christy was a social worker, and Mike owned his own business. And they thought their differences were behind them. They had met really young, and they had spent really most of their life growing up together and being together. And so they thought their differences didn't matter. But there were really real differences. So Christy, for example, when thinking about money, would often tell Mike, live for the day. Don't worry so much. Don't budget so much. Don't think about what you're going to spend so much before you would spend it. And Mike would say, yeah, you know, Christy has a really good point. I do think a lot about money. But at the same time, we have three kids we want to send to college. We have a mortgage. Maybe thinking about money is not such a bad idea. With work, Mike would often say to Christy, where do you want to get to next? What should be your next promotion or your next job? Let's think about that a little bit more. And Christy would say to Mike, you're always thinking about your business. Why don't you think about that a little bit less? It's going to be okay. You're really good at what you do. With emotions, Christy would often tell Mike, you know, why don't you express them a little bit more freely? And Mike would still feel kind of like, oh, you know, I see your point and I see where you're coming from, but I want to think about them a lot more and plan out what I'm going to say before I say it. So they had to navigate all of these differences about money, about work, about emotions. And these really fell along the dynamics again of how much do you want to plan or how much do you want to assume everything's going to be okay and let it kind of go with the flow.
Listening to stories like that, did you have a sense that at the end of the day that these marriages between socioeconomic classes were stronger or ultimately more rocky overall and maybe more likely to end in divorce?
I think they had to deal with more differences, but I don't think that necessarily meant that they were more likely to end in divorce. So if you look at divorce rates, they're actually very similar for people who married somebody who grew up in a different class or people who married somebody who grew up in the same class. So I think it's how many differences do you have to negotiate? But the couples that I talked to were very able to figure out how to negotiate them.
We'll be back in just a couple of minutes to hear the rest of our conversation with Jesse Strybe here on Central Time. And we'd like to hear from you on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you married to someone from a different economic class? And how has that played out in your relationship?
We'll hear more after a look at some of the latest news here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with sociologist Jesse Strybe, author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. She interviewed dozens of couples about the unique challenges facing people from different economic backgrounds.
Is this your story? Are you or were you in a relationship with someone who grew up richer or poorer than you? Did that cause problems or was it smooth sailing, no big deal? Do you think it's a bad thing that these cross-class marriages seem to be on the decline, a kind of economic segregation in marriage? Join the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with sociologist Jesse Strybe. She's the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. She interviewed dozens of couples about the unique challenges facing people from different economic backgrounds.
You can join the conversation. Are you in one of these cross-class marriages? Call in at 800-642-1234. Are there differences in the ways you approach money, raising kids, having a household? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got John on the line in Janesville. John, hi.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good. What's your story, John?
Well, I just recently married my wife. We've been together just over 2 months now after the marriage. We've been together a little longer than that. And she comes from a rather wealthy family, and I don't. I'm from the south suburbs of Chicago, very much working class, blue collar kind of family. And I actually didn't know that this was a subject of study, but it's been challenging at times.
How so? What have the challenges been? And first, congratulations, first of all, but what kind of challenges do you encounter because of those different backgrounds?
Well, first and foremost is just our different perceptions of money, I guess. That's kind of a nebulous thing to say. She has a bit of a loose interpretation of what it means to have money. I mean, she doesn't really seem to notice when she's spending it, or you know, it doesn't really occur to her that it's occasional that we may be short on funds. And fortunately for her, she's in a profession where that shouldn't really be a problem. But so I very much get nervous about the expenditures that we have, and we're looking at buying a home very soon, and that we're looking at houses that I would have never even considered stepping foot in as a child. Now it's within our budget.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Again, congratulations on your marriage. Jesse, so if you've grown up used to worrying about money and growing up not having to worry about money, is this a common problem, do you think, in marriages across classes?
Yeah, I do think it is a common problem. I more often saw the reverse, that the person from the working class background who now was middle class, you know, had grown up worrying about money and now found it to be such a luxury that they didn't have to worry about money anymore. Whereas their partner who had always been middle class was much more worried and much more wanting to monitor where their money was going. But I think what John is hitting on is kind of really marrying somebody very wealthy instead of somebody who's been really middle class. And you can imagine that if you've always had a ton of money, there's never been anything to worry about. And so spending a little bit extra doesn't really seem like a big deal when you've always had so much money. Several of my respondents who kind of married up also talked, like John did, about going into a much bigger house. And for some people, that was kind of an anxiety-ridden thing, that it symbolized to them how far they had come. And some people, that was really an important thing to show that. And for other people, it was really uncomfortable because it showed the world how different they were from their backgrounds when they really didn't want to be so different. And so it went both ways. But I think John's experience is not that unusual.
John, thanks a lot for that call. And some really interesting findings in your book about the houses. You found that a lot of people had anxiety about trying to create the perfect, seemingly middle-class house, especially if they had grown up more working class, that they sort of wanted to pass for being middle class, and their house was the emblem of that.
Exactly, and especially for women. So women are judged more on the appearance of their house. And some of the women had been judged a lot as children growing up in homes that they thought showed that they were poor. So now that they were middle class and they had enough money to live in a middle class house, they wanted to really make sure they got it right and make sure that people wouldn't come to their house and know that they had grown up poor. So some of them really obsessed over how to make their house look like the middle class house in their head. But the problem was, since they didn't grow up doing that and living in that type of house or having friends who lived in those types of houses, they didn't really know what to do. And so they would kind of read blogs and read magazines and watch TV shows and really try to figure it out. But they often felt like no matter how hard they tried, they weren't getting it quite right. And so it became something that they kept trying on and kept putting a lot of effort in to make sure that they had this middle class house and that they would no longer be judged.
Talking to sociologist Jesse Stribe. She's been studying people who marry outside of their own class, marry people from different economic backgrounds and the challenges and opportunities they face. Back to your calls now. We've got Elizabeth on the line in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting subject. I come from a more blue-collar working-class environment, and my husband, his father at one time was a multi-millionaire, so quite a difference. Nothing that I really thought about until we had a child, and our child is now a teenager. And just different things that come up. I'm definitely more worried about money. We did reach some financial hard times. I'm more on the worried side and you know, wanting to budget, et cetera, and wanting my child to, you know, work for, you know, either money or, you know, learn about responsibility with money. And I'm not as free as giving her extra funds, I think, as my husband is. And so I think that really has come to light. This subject is really interesting because it really brings a lot forth that I had never thought about before.
Elizabeth, thanks for sharing your story. Jesse, child raising, was that an issue where these different backgrounds created differences between parents?
Definitely at times. And one of the big differences is one that Elizabeth talks about, which is the idea of how much you want your kid to grow up working for things and how much responsibility you want your child to have. So a lot of the people who were upwardly mobile who I talked to said, I grew up struggling and I grew up making mistakes and having to learn from them. And nobody was there to prevent me from making a mistake. And that really helped me become resilient and become who I am today. So I want my child to have that too. I don't want to prevent them from making mistakes. I want them to make their own mistakes, and I want them to learn how to struggle. And people who didn't grow up having to struggle don't necessarily want their kids to have to struggle. And so they would have to try to figure out what's the right middle ground for this. Often with parenting, the woman had more control over kind of the whole parenting decision-making. And what happened was the wife got her way with it. But it was definitely a tension in the couples.
Well, thank you for that call, Elizabeth. And we'll go next to Martha in Milwaukee. Martha, hi.
Hi. My situation is that I came from a fairly well-to-do family, and education was stressed a lot. And I grew up appreciating people of other classes, which is what my husband is. He grew up very poor. But I find our marriage has been very enriching because we're able to compromise, and I think it tests our true love. I think knowing that he grew up poor, I appreciate things more, and I appreciate him more, and I learn a lot.
Great, Martha. Thank you so much for sharing that. And it sounds like Martha and her husband are open to change, to growth, to seeing things from another's perspective. Is that key to making this sort of situation work?
I don't know if it's key to making it work that you recognize that it's about social class, but I think you have to be open to being with somebody who's different than you and being with their family who is different than you. And being open to learning a new way of going about holiday rituals or how to think about money. Do you give your parents money or do you always expect your parents to give you money? Which way does that flow? How does gift giving work? How does planning work? How does child rearing work? And so you have to be open to doing things that aren't necessarily your way and not the way that you feel most comfortable with. But you don't have to know that it's about class to make that work.
Jesse's sociologist Robert Putnam in his most recent book says there are fewer opportunities for people from different classes to meet and interact, much less marry, and fewer interclass marriages over time. From your perspective, what do you make of that trend?
So I would say that there's two different trends going on. So the trend that Robert Putnam is talking about is cross-class marriages by college education. So somebody with a college degree marrying somebody with a high school degree, for example. And those marriages are becoming much, much less common over time. But the people who I interviewed aren't quite that set of people. They're people who now have college degrees, but they grew up in different social classes. And that type of marriage is actually becoming slightly more common. And so what we're seeing is people becoming perhaps more open to marrying across class lines of class background of the class that they grew up in, while becoming less open to the idea of marrying somebody who doesn't share your current class position or at least your current level of education.
That was Jesse Strieb, assistant professor of sociology at Duke University and author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages, talking about her recent research into the challenges of marrying people from different economic backgrounds.
Don't forget, we'd love to have you share your thoughts and experiences about marrying someone from a different economic class. You can do that over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we give another listen to a conversation with folklorist Jim Leary. His Folk Songs of Another America project was recently nominated for a Grammy Award. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at new FDA warnings on many over-the-counter pain relievers.
First, a new release is putting Wisconsin's rich ethnic diversity on the musical map. You might know the name Alan Lomax, the famous field collector of folk music whose work is now enshrined in the Library of Congress. Turns out Lomax, along with fellow field recorders Helene Stratman Thomas and Sidney Robertson, worked in the Upper Midwest, and for the first time ever, the music they recorded here and the people and stories behind them are being released in a new book from UW folklorist James Leary.
Jim Leary joins us in studio now. His book is called Folk Songs of Another America. He's professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison and director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. Jim, welcome back.
I'm very glad to be here.
Before we dig in, can you give me a sense of just how important, how big a deal these stories and recordings are to the musical history of the Upper Midwest?
Well, the musical history of the region has really not been well known. It's been there, but because it's been in so many languages other than English, people haven't really paid much attention to it. So what I've tried to do with this project is really bring some of this amazing music, along with a lot of background about it, to the fore, just to kind of place the region in its, what I think is its rightful place within the American folk music mosaic.
Well, right, when we think about Alan Lomax and think about the places that have these deep enshrined musical histories, you think maybe Appalachia, places like that, you don't necessarily think about the Midwest. Should we be thinking about the Midwest like that a little bit more?
Absolutely. Greil Marcus coined this phrase, the old weird America, kind of looking at the Harry Smith collection that Bob Dylan and the Grateful Dead and others drew on. And he was referring mostly to Southern Appalachian and African-American music with a little bit of cowboy songs and Cajun stuff. But there was just a comment in the L.A. Times about this project saying that the strange stuff of lumberjacks and various ethnic groups in the Upper Midwest is every bit as weird. So, and meaning, in a good way.
So we've got our own deep story and histories and weirdnesses here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Well, it sounds like your interest in this whole story was piqued a really long time ago when you were a kid, and you were piqued by a lumberjack musician up in northern Wisconsin. What caught your attention there? And just briefly, because I know that's a story in and of itself, but how did that lead to here?
Well, I was very glad, very lucky to grow up in Rice Lake, where an old guy named Otto Rindlisbacher, born in 1895, ran the Friendly Buckhorn Tavern. And against the back wall was the world's largest collection of odd lumber camp musical instruments. And so I, you know, got to go in there every now and then as a special occasion when I was growing up in the 1950s. And later I found out that he made recordings for the Library of Congress. So that kind of got me going.
And this book is a collection of stories, performers, music, and in all kinds of different languages, something like 200 performers collected from the 30s and 40s. Tell us, if you could, the backstory here. How did that music finally get to see the light of day?
Well, there was an emphasis on trying to record American folk songs, especially in the 1930s and into the 40s, for the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress. And most of it was in the, you know, the East, the West, and the South. But in the 1930s, during the Depression, a young woman named Sidney Robertson was sent here by Charles Seeger of the Resettlement Administration. She was based in Wisconsin. She knew about lumber camp songs and was trying to find them, but along the way she discovered Finns and Serbs and Scots Gaelic singers and French Canadians. So she wrote to Alan Lomax, who she knew, and said, someone really needs to come here and do more. He wanted to sweep through all of Michigan, Wisconsin, in Minnesota in 3 months in 1938. He didn't get past the UP except for one day up on the Odena Ojibwe Reservation, where he recorded a great Ojibwe fiddler, Joe Cloud. And so then he wrote to the School of Music at UW-Madison, seeing if anyone would take on the job. And Helene Stratman Thomas, who was a lecturer in music at the time, said, I'll do it. She got a young fellow, Bob Draves, who was a music student but also had training in audio engineering. And they set out. So in the summers of 1940 and 41, and then after World War II, and restrictions were lifted on travel and so forth, gas restrictions, they made a final surge in 1946. And between the three of them, Stratman Thomas, Lomax, and Sidney Robertson, they recorded about 2,000 songs and tunes in about 25 different languages. And because of the language challenges and because of the Upper Midwest being kind of an afterthought, most of this material has not been widely known or circulated.
Well, we can't go any further. We got to hear some as we talk to Jim Leary, author of Folk Songs of Another America. We're going to start off with one that you recommended, sung by Wallace Smith and Edward Webster. Can you tell us a little bit before we listen?
Yeah, these are Oneidas. They're singing in Oneida, but the Oneidas came here from kind of the New York-Ontario border area in the early 19th century, and a lot of them were Christians at the time. So this is sung in a harmony, kind of almost a shape note style singing. Some of them went to the Hampton Institute in Virginia, where African Americans were singing in kind of this style. And it's an incredible performance by these two guys. Right at the end, Jim Page, who's a leading shape note singer in this area, he emailed me last night. He said he thought he heard a woman's voice coming in very faintly. She's off mic, but she's sort of whispering and ghosting in. She couldn't control herself, so it's right at the end.
All right, here's a listen. Singing there from, you said, Oneida Native Americans here in Wisconsin.
That's right.
Remarkable for a bunch of reasons, as you said. What strikes you as you just listen to it?
Well, I love the quality of the voices, you know, the way they soar and resonate and the passion in them. And, you know, it just takes me to another place, I guess.
Yeah, their voices are really strong and solid in that harmony singing. It's incredible. And another you sent us was called Sinai Beach.
Shawnee Bach.
Or Shawnee Bach.
Shawnee Bach. Yeah, it's hard.
This is why I'm going to let you introduce the rest of them.
This is a Welsh song recorded in the context of a Gamafagani or Welsh hymn singing event in Pickett, Wisconsin. And it's a really great leader call and response kind of song.
Yeah. All right, here's that one. Beautiful recording. Quality is excellent, too. I'll have to ask you about that on some of these recordings that we're listening to. They've been remastered, I know, but what's the story behind this one?
Well, this was recorded in a church. I mean, it's a field recording. We had to work from the original discs, transfer them to digital format, and then go through a long process of sound restoration, including with some trying to work out time, because the stuff was not always recorded at exactly the same RPM. But this was recorded pretty well in the first place, but the work that Mike Graves of Osiris Studio did really kind of brought the sound out, and that's been really exciting with this project, that we've not only been able to bring forward the songs but have them translated and have the original language, but also to make them sound really good, especially for old field recordings.
How did the song catchers, as they're sort of called, know where to look for their music? Did they just get a lead and then they tracked it down? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, Sidney Robertson knew about a guy named L.G. Sorden, who was a county agent for UW Extension up in Rhinelander. She got contacts from him and then kind of followed their networks. Alan Lomax knew about a bunch of ethnic groups in Wisconsin that were in Michigan, that were in certain communities, and he tried to go there. Stratman Thomas publicized her quest through Wisconsin Public Radio, but also through Madison and Milwaukee newspapers. And then she had students who came from a lot of these communities or acquaintances, and they said, well, go up to Washington Island, they're Icelandic singers, or go down to Darlington, there's an Austrian group, or go to New Glarus, and you could hear a Swiss zither player.
And I understand in the preserving of these, that Mills Music Library had something to do with it, and the collaboration there. Also, Judy Rose, one of our former and beloved hosts of Simply Folk, did too. What was their contribution?
Absolutely. Way back in the late 60s or early 70s, Dave Peterson of UW Extension knew about these recordings, and he made sure that copies were here. And then Judy, her name was Judy Woodward at the time, produced 13 amazing programs called the Wisconsin Patchwork back in the 1980s based on the Stratman Thomas recordings. I was really lucky to consult on those, and then Dave hired me later to write a little book that went with them, so that got me going. But Judy was very much kind of in the forefront of delving into Helene Stratman Thomas's recordings.
We're talking with Jim Leary right now about the release of new Archiville recordings from Wisconsin and other places in the upper Midwest from the 30s and 40s. The music was collected by Helene Stratman Thomas, Alan Lomax, and Sidney Robertson. Jim's new book is called Folk Songs of Another America.
And you can call in with your memories, your questions. Do you remember some of these songs? Did you grow up with folk music, singing it, or maybe a parent or grandparents singing the old ethnic folk songs to you as you grow up? Did you see this rich ethnic diversity that's been collected in these recordings? If you're a musician trying to keep these traditions alive, call and tell us about that too. Call 800-64 421234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Jim Leary about the release of new archival recordings from Wisconsin and other places in the upper Midwest from the 30s and 40s. That music collected by Helene Stratman Thomas, Alan Lomax, and Sidney Robertson. Jim Leary's new book is called Folk Songs of Another America.
We'll listen to some more of the songs from the collection, which includes CDs, and you can join in with your memories and your questions. Do you remember hearing folk songs from your ethnic heritage as you grew up? Did you grow up singing these, hearing your parents or grandparents sing them? Did you see this kind of ethnic diversity growing up? Do you perform some of these songs now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jim, we'll go back to the music now, and one that you like a lot from a Swiss performer. This one's called Landjäger. What do we need to know about that?
Well, this is by Al Miller, originally from New Glarus. In the 1940s, he made an electric zither, and he later made his living in Milwaukee, played at the Golden Zither and Zirkrona. I actually got to meet him in the mid-80s while doing a project, but it's a wonderful, wonderful piece on the zither.
Lovely one there. It's, again, the recording, the quality of it and the precision of the playing is really striking, considering that it was recorded, what would you say, the 40s?
Yeah, this was in 1941. This was, I think, maybe the first recording she made was down in New Glarus.
Now, in terms of what the song collectors were after, they were looking for, I know, lumberjack songs, sailor songs. What else was on their list?
Well, particularly in Wisconsin and Michigan, Minnesota, they wanted to capture some of the ethnic and immigrant material, and that really had not been done. Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, was kind of the first place where that kind of diversity was acknowledged. You know, just like nowadays, there are people who thought any kind of cultural and linguistic diversity needed to be suppressed, and especially by public institutions, and it was their job to turn people into homogenized, so-called homogenized Americans. And there was a recognition by these folklorists that, you know, it takes all stripes to build a country, and it's worth having some kind of pluralism or diversity. So they were interested in those voices, and these songs were not static. There were songs that people were making up about coming to America. One was by some Italians up in Cumberland who sang a song about the experience of immigrating to America, for example.
Would that be America's Most Beautiful?
That is it.
Let's hear that one.
America, Santa Bella, l'Italia piccolina, sono scritta la mia biondina, all'età non ci torna più. Sono scritta
is America e Tanto Bello from, where did you say that was?
This was recorded
again?
In Cumberland. And actually the organizer, Tom St. Angelo, was a longtime member of the Wisconsin Assembly, came from an immigrant family, served in the Republican Party. The library in Cumberland is named for him, and he organized this little group. This was a song that he heard from his mother, and it's about America is so beautiful, Italy is so small. This is a young man writing from this country, and then the woman he's writing to says, "Mother, pack my bag. I'm going to America."
And so it did, that song. Okay, here's a caller we're going to bring in on this. Mary Kay joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I come from an Italian family as well. My family are from the northwest part of Italy called Piemonte. And my grandmother used to sing songs to us when we were kids. And I made her sing them enough so I could memorize them. I don't know that they ever had names except for one. But one of them was a lullaby that I sang for my children, and I've sung it for my grandchildren. And they got to the point where when they would hear me start to sing it, they would tell me, "No, Nana," because they didn't want to go to bed. They knew it was time to go to bed. But I don't have a translation for them. I just remember the words is all. I don't even know if you can find them recorded anywhere, to be honest with you.
Right. Yeah, that's an amazing story. You got to keep singing it to them, you know, and hopefully they'll be able to keep singing it to their kids as the song goes along and their lives go along. What does that say to you, stories like that, Jim?
Well, I think that's wonderful, and I think there are a lot of songs like that are out there. There just aren't enough of us folklorists out there, but you know, these songs are worth remembering, and it may be that if you or someone can actually write down the words in Italian. Nowadays, you can almost Google, type in a whole line into a search engine, and you can find out about the song. There's actually been a lot of work done on Italian-American folk songs and Italian folk songs. There are archives of them. So maybe there's hope in finding out more about the song.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mary Kay. Appreciate that. Jim, do you have a sense of how many of these songs and performers, or at least the legacy of the performers, lives on today, or has a lot of this music disappeared?
You know, I think a lot of it has disappeared. There are some polka traditions, some older fiddling traditions that you find elements of. Music, of course, is always changing. There are so-called 49 songs, powwow drum songs in English. They're still being sung. The Oneidas are still singing hymns. So there are elements of these songs that one can still find, but a lot has changed as well. A lot of these are lost voices.
We're talking to UW folklorist Jim Leary right now about his new book, Folk Songs of Another America, which has folk music recordings from the 30s and 40s, recorded by Alan Lomax and others throughout the Upper Midwest. And do you have a favorite among this collection, something that you got especially close to?
You know, I love them all, but my dad was born in Chippewa Falls, and my grandmother lived, was French-Canadian.
You mean Chippewa Falls?
Chippewa Falls. So we got a little bit about how they sang the Marseillaise, and this is an invocation of a bunch of old-timers in Chippewa Falls.
Okay, we've got a little bit of that recording here, and it begins with an introduction.
Now, folks, I would like to tell you something about in the early 1900s, oh, I should judge about 1906 or 7, I run across a French-Canadian old lumberjack, and he met me one evening in the old saloon days, and he says, how do you do? Your name is Cardinal, ain't it? I says, yes, sir, it is. Well, he says, you know, Mr. Cardinal, I'm used to know your father pretty well. And I know your uncle, too, used to keep the hotel. And say, you know, Mr. Cardinal, I'm like to tell you something. You know how they sing the Marseillaise in Chippewa Falls? I says, no, I do not. Well, he says, this is the way they sing the Marseillaise in Chippewa Falls. Almost Sarrazin and Felix Cardinal, Johnny Thériault.
How they sang the Marseillaise in Chippewa Falls. Not really called that much anymore, I bet. What do you hear in this one, Jim?
I don't think they call it that anymore either. But that was Charles Cardinal. He was a house painter and quite a character. Judy Rose got to talk to him. He was still living in the 80s. He was in his 90s when she produced her earlier shows.
And, you know, the Midwest, the Upper Midwest, particularly known for its Great Lakes, any sailing songs, I don't know if there are any that we have now, but any that really struck you, there must be a strong tradition there.
You know, there were some wonderful sailing songs, especially recorded on Beaver Island in Michigan, and I didn't include those in here because a lot of the English language stuff, or at least some of it, has been released. There was a guy named Ivan Walton who did superb work along with Alan Lomax, and there are two books based on his work and another one called Beaver Island House Party by Laurie Summers that have those songs. So I left him out of this collection, but they're definitely really good ones about shipwrecks and storms and one thing or another, exciting adventures on the Great Lakes.
And as we wrap up, what is your hope about how this collection will go forth into the world and change the way people think about the music and the culture of the Upper Midwest?
Well, I hope people will recognize the cultural pluralism and the richness of the folk music in here. And I also hope that people will, especially in communities, but more broadly, start to sing these songs again and kind of get them back into circulation. And not only can you hear the music, but the words in the original language, English translations, background.